Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your peak raw of music news and cultural awareness. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff.
First things first, I'm the realest.
Realest.
Drop this and let the whole world feel it.
Let them feel it.
And I'm still in the murder business. I can hold you down like I'm giving lessons in physics.
Right, right.
You should want a bad dude like this.
Huh?
Drop it low and pick it up just like this.
Yeah.
Cup of Ace, cup of Goose, cup of Chris. High heels, something worth a half a ticket on my wrist.
Back. On my wrist.
Taking all the liquor straight. Never chase that.
Never.
Stop like we bring an 88 back. What?
With us are the three other popular music critics of the New York Times, Nate Chenin, John Caramonica, and John Pareles. Hello, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. Back.
On this episode, we're going to talk about themes in pop in the year 2014. All of them.
Yeah.
In alphabetical order. But we're going to start out of alphabetical order with the letter I for Iggy.
Mm. Oh, I thought you were going to talk about Kendrick Lamar. I'm so disappointed.
Yeah.
We just heard Fancy by Iggy Azalea.
Oh, yeah.
It begins with an A, by the way.
That's true.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe you should consider how you alphabetize your collection.
We heard Fancy by Iggy Azalea, a song which was hard to escape, easy to think about.
Like literally, as in like terrorism.
Yeah. And which brought up actually a number of themes about music this year. Start with one, John Caramonica.
Well, okay. First of all, I mean, let's look at where we were roughly this time last year, right? We're maybe give or take a month. You know, you're at the 2014 Grammys, early February of this year.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 and a half months ago. And of course, what happens, except the obvious, which is Macklemore wins basically all the rap Grammys.
Yes.
Which, you know, is sort of like the white future of hip hop that we've all been dreading. And there it is. It's just like very unapologetically just happened. Like there wasn't sort of like a slow build to it. People gave Eminem a pass for all those years because of his loyalty, his fealty to the culture. And then Macklemore just showed up and just like literally just stole things. And so people got, I think, quite reasonably freaked out and say, oh, no, like, is this what hip hop is going to be moving forward? Or at least is this what like officially acknowledged hip hop is going to be moving forward? Look, I reviewed shows by a number of white rappers this year, you know, G-Eazy and Air, and there's all these other guys who are sort of moving in spaces that are basically colleges or white suburban kids. But you go to those shows and you don't really have the feeling that any of those guys are going to come and like become huge pop stars. I mean, G-Eazy maybe, but like generally speaking, you don't have that feeling. And then Iggy Azalea finally coalesces into a thing. Like Iggy Azalea has been like failing to coalesce into a thing for probably 2 years now. And then they gave her a fake DJ Mustard record, which is Fancy, in a year full of real DJ Mustard hip hop hits. So here you have a white Australian woman rapping over something that's like a kind of like first generation Xerox of a contemporary rap record.
Yes. And all of a sudden she became a threat.
More than a threat.
And her attitude is a Xerox too. The whole champagne sipping, high living shtick is a contrivance, as we say.
Yeah, and I struggled a lot with Iggy this year because there were moments of just complete like palm to forehead nonsense. Just both musically and also when she would talk. Sometimes she would say things that were just wrong. Just flat out wrong. Like when you're a white participant in the black culture, like one would think that you've given some thought to racial issues. And my feeling is she hadn't spent a lot of time thinking about that stuff. But then she also proved to be weirdly durable in the same way. Like when people critiqued her, she would fight back. And sometimes quite logically, I thought, like people would say, why don't you rap in an Australian accent, or why don't you this, or why don't you that? And she was like, hip hop was aspirational for me. Like all I ever wanted to do was be a rap star. And so I'm now I'm an American rap star. And like, I did it. Mm-hmm. I did it. I'm proof that anything is possible. If you're a privileged white woman, sure. That's part of it too. But Iggy kind of really wrote a crazy narrative this year that was in parts offensive, but in parts really shocking. And also, I think is going to have 1,000 think pieces launched in 6 weeks from now. When at the Grammys, she wins one or two of those.
Right.
Well, it was interesting. How many did she win at the VMAs? She won like 3 or 4 awards. And every time, infallibly, she was squired to the stage by T.I. I couldn't tell after the maybe second or third time. I couldn't tell if she still actually wanted to be squired to the stage or not. Yeah, I feel like there was something missing in her addressing the position she's in. But there is a kind of
She understands.
She's been vouched for on some level.
Except for those people who are like, who's that old man with Iggy Azalea? Who's that guy?
But
is that her grandfather?
It did seem like there were many different takes on her sort of validity. And some people who you would be surprised, like some people who you would expect to just reject her out of hand were like, no, she's doing it.
I don't really enjoy a lot of the record, but I found her harder to outright reject as a player in the world, even though she did some genuinely bad things this year. Like on the night of the Eric Garner grand jury, you know, she's tweeting about her tour. And it's just baffling to me. Like, how could you be this person? It doesn't make any sense. But at the same time, when she finally did talk at length about various things over the year, like sometimes she stumbled onto good ideas. She was tough. She was a vexing character this year, I thought.
But much of the music is so secondhand.
Oh, sure. But I think for a lot of teenage girls, it's not. I think Fancy for a lot of teenage girls is just like, it's just it. And it's like a perfect entry song. I mean, it's like, I like rap, but I don't want to listen to the YG record. So I'll listen to something that sounds a lot like the YG record rapped by a white woman.
With that hook.
Oh, sure. Dude, yeah. It's also called Hollaback Girl. And also she sort of emerged, I thought, in the middle of a wave of like other – there's like a little bit of sea change in the personalities of pop. And she arrived in concert with Ariana Grande. Mm-hmm. And there's the big there's the Jessie J – the song with Jessie J, their Bang Bang song. There's all these sort of collaborative pop songs with women, which means that in order for someone to pierce the pop – ether, you could do it with a partner. You could do it with a tag team. And so it's a little easier for Iggy to kind of break through because she can do it hand in hand with Ariana.
Right.
She can do it hand in hand with Rita Ora. There are all these people who, like, if you give them good records, they're able to get attention. And so it wasn't just one woman taking on the pop and hip-hop establishment. It was actually kind of like a phalanx of younger women all kind of stepping into their roles this year.
A phalanx or a clique, though?
I think of phalanx. I don't think they're actually all friends.
That's impossible.
Yeah, I know. It's like, weird, right?
And Nicki Minaj.
Who's actually more established? And I think sort of the issue with Nicki, her album hasn't come out as of this recording of the podcast. The pink print has not yet been released. Nicki's been in an interesting position as someone who is probably one of the three best technical rappers working in the mainstream right now. Maybe two best technical rappers working in the mainstream. Who, like, somehow manages to not have great albums. Like, her pop ear is maybe not as refined as it could be. Iggy Azalea is now the second white female rapper, Kesha being the first, who have come up in the sort of era of Nicki Minaj and put out, theoretically, better albums. Now, I don't love the Iggy Azalea record. Mm-hmm. I did like a lot of the Kesha music. I don't love the Iggy Azalea. I mean, the Iggy record. But they're doing things that Nicki, by all rights, should be doing. So it's an interesting moment to be Nicki Minaj because female rap is suddenly very of the moment. And yet Nicki Minaj, who basically opened the door for all these women, is not reaping all the benefits of it.
Can I just raise the point that 2014 was also a year without Kesha?
Except in lawsuits.
Except in lawsuits, right. But music, no. I think nothing. There was some track on SoundCloud that she was part of in some way, but, you know, may be premature or part of somebody else's
Kesha,
deal,
I mean,
or whatever.
It seems like the industry has been unkind to Kesha.
Yep.
So hopefully that will change.
Hope so, too.
Because Kesha's got a lot of ideas.
She sure does. However, there was the video game about Kesha. Did you see that?
No.
By Porpentine.
Not up on that.
Just Google it.
Sure.
Porpentine, Kesha. Moving on. Let's talk about Idina Menzel.
The great, super solid transition. That's actual girl power. There's a lot of fake girl power in pop this year. Here's some actual girl power.
Let it go, let it go. Can't hold it back anymore. Let it go, let it go. Turn away and slam the door. I don't care what they're going to say. Let the story.
That was Let It Go by Idina Menzel, a song very well known to Nate Chanin.
A not unfamiliar fixture of my day-to-day existence as the father of a four-year-old girl. By a wide, wide margin the song most heard by these ears in 2014. A pretty solid song, well sung. You know, I have to get behind the sentiment of Let It Go and Frozen in general. It's been interesting to observe it at close range and its psychological influence, while also thinking or attempting to think critically about, you know, the way that this juggernaut exists in the world, Halloween costumes, and the melody to Let It Go has been repurposed many times by many people in my house, including myself, to urge people to eat their dinner or, you know, you use whatever you've got.
Those are real life memes.
Oh, yeah.
That's not a hashtag. That's not an Instagram meme. That's a real life meme.
But, you know, when you talk about a cohort, a demographic, you know, and our producer, Jeremy Eggner, belongs to the same group as I
want to give those ears a bath.
Yeah. Yeah. I can hardly think of a moment in my lifetime when there was something that resonated so strongly with a particular group specifically, you know, and it was like you could still be into the song if you were not a 4-year-old girl. But there was something like it was just hitting that frequency. It'll be fascinating to see what the actual sort of impact of this song is on that generation of consumers and people in the world.
Baby musicians too.
Yeah, I mean, not only in terms of sort of girl power and kind of like standing for yourself, but also like the songcraft, and you know, it's a well constructed melody and it goes places, and there are a lot of kids belting it out at the top of their lungs, and that's, you know, that counts for something. I don't know what yet, but
for making Taye Diggs's ears bleed.
My Idina Menzel story this year was that I happened to see If Then with one of my children the day after she played Radio City. I mean, you know, so here we were in this Broadway theater, you know, nice old theater, a little bigger than my apartment, but not that much.
I mean,
it's kind of a small place when you get right down to it.
In your apartment.
So, you know, here she was the night after she sold out Radio City. Who knows why? Because she'd been doing this show for a while, but she messed up a couple of lines. She was like unbelievable charm and work ethic. My feeling at the end of that performance was, my God, I really respect the work ethic of this woman. Wow. What a trooper in like the old sense.
Oh, yeah. She certainly is. And that's, you know, that's some of the message of the character that she plays in that movie. I have wondered a little bit, like, what, I don't know if anyone's reported this out. What is her take? Did she get points on that album? Did she get points on the movie? You know, like, what was it a percentage thing? Was, you know, it's, she could have made like $2 million on that record, or she could have made like
$22,000.
Easy. Yeah. Well, or like more, you know, or much more.
But there's no writing on it, right?
I don't think there's writing, you know, but it's like,
I've got to assume Disney owns everything. Yeah. I've got to assume. But she gets to put out, like, she put out like a super anonymous Christmas record, which she probably wouldn't have had the opportunity.
In my house, referred to as the Elsa Christmas record.
Sure, that is true. Produced by Walter Afanasieff, or however you pronounce that guy's last name.
Oh, Mariah Carey fame.
Yeah, who should have just left it there.
That version of All I Want for Christmas Is You is just, oh, it's awful.
Maybe now's the time to raise the fact that women were making serious moves, not just in movie theaters, not just in the top 10 singles, but in indie rock. This was like a very good year.
I thought so.
Very diverse year, too. I mean, you have Angel Olsen, who's Velvet Underground and country. You have St. Vincent, who's from another planet. You have Sharon Van Etten, who has gone from being a solo folky type to this retro tragedy figure. All these good songs are out there.
Frankie Cosmos, who I loved. Super weird, awkward. I saw her play at Glasslands for like maybe as many people as are in this room right now. Small, contained, interior life songs. Kevin Kline standing in the background taking pictures. It's his daughter standing in the back of the room taking pictures. Angel Olsen also I really liked. A lot of heat on that record.
Like just, I love just, the Orbison undercurrent too. That just gets me.
The other thing I thought about was, okay, to a certain kind of person, in the 90s, not saying that person was me, but you know, like the three very significant alt-rock bands or whatever would be Sonic Youth,
yep.
The Boredoms, and Royal Trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And from those bands—
Definitely not you.
And from
about.
Those bands came O-O-I-O-O, Bodyhead, yep. and Black Bananas, mm-hmm. three bands that are like kind of killing it. At the moment,
mm-hmm.
you know? I mean, either making great performances or recordings or whatever. And those are, you know, records featuring the woman in those bands who, in two of those cases, you know, was also doing stuff on the side outside of the band during the major moment of the band. But now coming into their own in this amazing way in middle age.
And
that
think,
seems significant to me because we're talking about indie rock, which was supposed to be the province of feminism, even in the 90s, mm-hmm. was supposed to be the area where women had a space to be powerful and et cetera. In some cases, it takes a while.
Yes, but also, I mean, look at, let's talk about Perfect Pussy. Let's talk about White Lung.
Yeah, good.
Two great records this year that also felt very early to mid-90s to me.
Mm-hmm.
Also, say your mid-90s were defined not by those bands, but by Hole
yeah.
and by Liz Phair.
Yeah.
You know, there's the EMA record that came out this year that I don't like as much as the first EMA record. It was really good. Brody Dahl had a good record this year, weirdly.
Mm-hmm.
I think my favorite mainstream, quote-unquote, rock record of this year was The Pretty Reckless, and which I think is not a band that anyone cares about. It's Taylor Momsen, who used to be on Gossip Girl.
Mm-hmm.
It is a sleazy, dirty, it sounds like Motley Crue and Hole having a baby. I regret not really writing about it this year. Maybe I will write something later at the end of the year. That record is so alive to me. And to me, that group of records, White Lung, Pretty Reckless, EMA, that refers to a different 90s idea of
yeah.
what feminism and indie rock is.
That's right.
That still feels very much alive.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Perfect Pussy is just like in its own universe. Not its own universe, but at least in the moment in kind of its own universe.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Girlpool. I mean, there's a lot of great stuff this year.
Yeah, baby. I hear you over there on your tailgate whistling in. Saying, hey, girl, but you know I ain't listening. Cause I got a name and to you it ain't.
And that was Girl in a Country Song by Maddie and Tay, currently high on the country
charts. The number one, theoretically, I think it's the number one Billboard country song right now, which took weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. I mean, in the way that country charts operate in glacial pace, but it took, months for that to happen. And I think that song feels like it has a lot of consonance with some of the female indie rock that we were just talking about. Although this song is like much more obviously a direct slap at everything else that's happening in country music, which are bro culture, truck songs,
yeah.
Very mundane masculinity.
Yeah.
And this is a rejection of that.
Well, and the fact that it's taken the idea of the woman in the background.
The hood ornament
hey, in country songs. That's what the Gamergate thing was about.
It wasn't about ethics in gaming journalism?
Actually.
No. Oh, jeez.
I mean,
I'm reading my Twitter feed's all wrong.
So it's like... it's very now.
I have a theory about this song. This is a song that Maddie and Tay are signed to Big Machine. Big Machine is Taylor's label. It's not there's any lack of push behind this song. I don't actually love the song as art. I like it as politics. I like it as statement making. I like it as high profile glossy rejection of the high profile central scene. I like it as all that. I don't love it as a song. I don't love the singing on it. I do think that there's been a tremendous amount of backlash within mainstream country against the idea of hegemony of country radio and how narrow the programming can be on country radio mm-hmm. and how even really established female stars have a difficulty cracking playlists. Even someone like Miranda or Carrie, it's very tough if you're not Miranda or Carrie to end up on a – but whereas like any Joe Blow with a truck, Chase Rice – John Party, Eric Paisley, like just any of these guys can just have a hit kind of out of nowhere. But a young female singer or even established female singer really has a challenge. I don't want to say that there's like a cabal of country radio programmers sitting in a room, but there's maybe a cabal of country radio programmers sitting in a room just being like, let's just let them have this one. Mm-hmm. And like, we'll all just kind of get on board and like, we'll look cool. Like, we'll look smart for playing it. Mm-hmm. I don't think it'll be replicated. I don't think there's a second Maddie and Tay single. I don't think there's a second protest single.
Right.
But I do feel like there was a little bit of a like
cynicism.
Look, I don't want to denigrate the success of that song or that duo. I do think there are real reasons.
Don't you think that there are people who want to hear that? I mean, I've always been struck.
Of course.
Absolutely.
I mean, angry woman songs, I think, are the secret. A goldmine that country music will not tap. There's the Dixie Chicks song, Goodbye to Earl.
Yeah, Goodbye to Earl. Any half of Reba McEntire songs.
Yeah, I mean, when women get mad, you can see it at shows, and the audience is like, hands go up, people are shouting along, and country radio is like, we don't really want to touch this too much.
Well, no, I agree. You have to assume cynicism.
Is there some kinship between Girl and a Country Song? I'm just putting this out there.
Yeah.
And Meghan Trainor?
It's about girl positive,
and
acceptance outside the norms.
Right. It's coming from a different place, but she's taking a stance, but in a very playful way, in a much less sort of
confrontational,
much less confrontational, and much more like, you know, bubbly and shrugging her shoulders. Mm-hmm. Not every form, you know, and that's not a song that I like.
Meghan Trainor.
Yeah,
I'm warmed up to it a little bit.
I don't know that we would have picked that as a number one single in the country at any point prior to its reign. But again, a song about kind of attacking a trope, pushing an exception or something.
Sure.
But the difference is that it's not within the country. It's not within the country.
No, although Meghan Trainor is a country songwriter.
Right.
Like that's like no one's talking about that. Like Meghan Trainor is when I first found all about that bass, I started Googling Meghan Trainor and trying to find out what her story was. And like the first biographical hit that I could find on her was on a Nashville publishing company's website. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure.
So maybe the cabal decided that they would let them have more than one.
Let them have different cabals, related cabals. Like, you know, one meets on Tuesdays, one meets on Wednesdays.
They're in two adjacent hotel suites with Garth off in the next one.
Absolutely. Just filming. Do you know what's happening in the suite next door?
He's tearing down the walls.
You know, Megan and Iggy, it's an interesting year for, again, white women participating either directly or indirectly in hip-hop culture. That was literally, what, one-third of the weeks of the year at number one on the Billboard Hot 100 were those two songs, Fancy and All About That Bass.
And creating their own reasons for why they're participating in hip-hop culture?
I think certainly they were not invited.
Yeah.
In the same way that, you know, we talked last week about R&B trickling down and infecting a lot of different people who are making spin-off sounds or branches or tributaries. This is sort of like these are spin-off sounds and ideas of years and years of white participation in hip-hop. Mm-hmm. You know, All About That Bass is not a hip-hop song, but it's basically a hip-hop idea. Mm-hmm. And Fancy is sort of a hip-hop song. It's a hip-hop song. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a hip-hop song enough that it'll probably win a Grammy next year. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Grammys, I think that we all know what the album of the year is going to be.
Oh, yeah. Do we? Sam Smith.
We'll look so bad if we're wrong. But
who'll look bad is Grammy voters. Mm.
But it seems like it'll be the Sam Smith record.
Doesn't it, though? Like, it just sort of, yes. I mean, talking
they
about
they do love their ballads.
It is the most fait accompli thing of all faits and all accomplis. Look, it's the Adele record. It's the Lauryn Hill. It's like a very polite updating of classic soul music. This is something that I think is a real sweet spot for Grammy voters. Mm-hmm. A modern updating of the sound that they grew up loving. You know, Norah Jones. I mean, all this stuff, I think, very comfortably fits in the same continuum. So I'd be really surprised if that didn't win. I'm not saying it deserves to win. You know, what does deserve mean anyway? It feels like it's a done deal. The cabals have agreed.
Why gotta be so rude?
Yeah. I mean, if that won, at least it'd be interesting. At least give me something to write about.
I mean, the Brits do have a gift for being so far behind the curve that they can sell it back to us. That's the traditional British approach to American popular music.
Icy cold.
And I think by voting for them, we can subtly show our own self-hatred.
I didn't know about that.
No, maybe it's all about the haircuts. It's not just that they're behind the curve.
They have better haircuts.
Traditionally.
Definitely has better haircuts. Sam Smith has this one really great jacket.
Yeah, I was thinking about the coat.
That long coat thing. Whatever that coat is, that coat should get a Grammy.
Part Matrix, part,
Undertaker.
Yeah,
it's like part Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Yeah. Like, it's a thing. Give that coat a Grammy.
It's not just that they're behind the curve, right? They're altering it in some way. They're altering what we already know.
They're replaying. So. They're taking a memory of it, and memories are a little fuzzy.
Altering would be if Disclosure was going to win Album of the Year, but that's not going to happen. Is Sam Smith fundamentally an alteration?
It's not like they're categorically changing. I'm saying they're changing the particulars of it. They're changing the fine stuff.
I just don't even think that that's right. It doesn't feel altered to me.
Altered in the sense that another soul singer will want to try to sound like Sam Smith?
They're using American tropes, but they're changing them just enough.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Just enough.
I thought you were saying that what someone like Sam Smith or Adele does alters the rest of everything, that it's like a transformative force.
No. They're altering the source material.
But I don't think that that's why it's working, because it's altering? Is that what you're contending? That's why it's working?
It's working because we love to hear stuff that we're familiar with in a slightly different way, and it's working because we don't like Americans. Americans don't like Americans.
I don't think there's that self-hatred. I think that there's – I just think that we're more nostalgic than we think we are. It's not self-hatred. It's sort of fear of the present. Revivalism is a return to a comfortable past.
No, I'm kind of joking when I say we don't like Americans. But I'm just saying that it's always a novelty to us that there are people from other countries who might even speak our language. You know what I mean? They're like they just seem so interesting and so unlike us. I don't know. I just think the fascination continues and will continue.
I feel like it's notable that that's kind of the best that we can say about Sam Smith. Mm-hmm. And I feel bad a little bit. I've said some kind things about Sam Smith. I listened to his record again, in advance of the year-end list stuff, and I think it holds up. There's stuff on there I think is sallow, but he's got some songs on there. And he's obviously a technical singer, he's pretty good. But it's hard to get excited about Sam Smith. And I think that's probably why we're all sort of like, it's about Americans hating themselves, mm-hmm. and it's about his coat, and it's about – is it about Sam Smith? That I don't know. And I think that's really a challenge. Like, even with the sort of most recent similar example, you could say is Adele. But there's something a little bit anonymous about Adele. She doesn't do a lot of press. She's not really talky. She sort of disappears between records. But I kind of feel like people are really into Adele. Like, they're conceptually into Adele as a person, as a thing. I'm not sure.
People love Adele.
Yeah. Right.
Okay,
Sam Smith is a little bit tofu-like.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah. Maybe that's why we're all struggling. I mean, I had a Sam Smith song on my my songs list, not mm-hmm. in that way, which is not one of the singles, but I think it's a tremendous song. Mm-hmm. But it's a little hard to get excited about Sam Smith as a person, as a full living entity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the conundrum that we're facing, and that I don't think Grammy voters are facing, because I don't think they think about it. But I think certainly moving forward, it's something that Sam Smith has to contend with.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe he'll reveal some depth on his troubled second album.
I can't wait. Let's trouble it up.
Oh, won't you stay with me? 'Cause you're all I need. This ain't love, it's clear to see. But darling, stay with me.
And I hope you stay with us next week when we'll be doing our Jazz of the Year 2014 podcast, me and Nate Chenin.
Coffee Clutch.
Thank you to Nate Chenin, John Caramonica, John Pareles. Thank you to our producers, Jeremy Egner and Jocelyn Gonzalez. Look up all the stuff we've been talking about on our Spotify playlist. We'll see you next week.
Oh, won't you stay with me? 'Cause you're darling, stay.